from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. Sugar and empty calories seem to be the topics of the day. New York's Mayor Bloomberg wants to ban big sugar sodas. The city of Richmond wants to tax sugary beverages. It's all a part of what we'll talk about in the next hour on Forum with Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University. She's one of the nation's top food gurus, and she's got a new book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. We'll chat about sweet drinks, diets, government dictates, obesity, and how it all relates to you and your family. And you can join the conversation. That's on Forum right after this. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. There's a national debate going on about whether the government, be it New York or Richmond, California, should tell us what we can eat and drink and what we can't. The current focus of that controversy is over sugary beverages, sweet iced tea, soda, and the like, with much of the medical community saying that it contributes to obesity and other health issues, empty calories. Calories, that's the key word in a new book called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, written by Marion Nessel and Malden Nessheim.
Nessel.
Professor Nessel is our guest on Forum today. She's a professor of nutrition, food studies, public health, and sociology at New York University, and she's written widely about food and politics, one of the nation's top experts in the field that pertains to all of us. Welcome to Forum.
Oh, glad to be here.
Okay. Everybody thinks they know about calories. I mean, yeah, don't eat so many calories, you're gonna get too fat. Calories are bad. Why a book telling us about calories? What are you going to tell us about calories that we don't already know?
Well, what we're finding out from this book is that people reading it say they had no idea about any of this. We wrote the book, Why Calories Count, because of public confusion about it. There's so much misunderstanding and confusion about what calories are, where they are, how many you need, whether it matters whether how many you eat or where the calories come from. Many, many misunderstandings about it, going with their very name of whether we're not really talking about calories, we're really talking about kilocalories. That kind of thing just drives people crazy. And calories are associated with the two most important public health nutrition problems in the world today, too few calories and too many.
Too few calories, malnutrition,
and hunger and starving and starvation. And there are about a billion people in the world who don't have enough calories to maintain weight and health. And then another billion who are overweight.
Now, you threw in a little zinger as you were talking, just sort of passed it off. But I found it kind of interesting. We're not really talking about calories. We're talking about kilocalories.
Yeah, 1,000 times bigger.
So a real calorie is a very, very small amount.
Oh, yeah, tiny.
It's tiny. It's not going to make you fat, one calorie.
Not even one kilocalorie is going to make you fat.
But a kilocalorie is 1,000 times more than a calorie. And you spell it with a capital C versus a small.
Yeah, but you can't see the capital C when you're talking.
No.
So the word calorie means two different things at exactly the same time.
But when we're talking about them here and when most people talk about them, they're talking about kilocalories, a larger measurement of
Yeah, it's the calorie that's on food label.
Right.
It's not really a calorie. It's a kilocalorie.
Okay, but we're going to call it a calorie.
But we call it a calorie. We are.
Okay, now doesn't everybody know that if you eat a lot of calories, you're going to get fat?
Yes and no. It's not intuitively obvious, and the most obvious place where I can show that it's not intuitively obvious is in large portions. If there's one thing about calories that really, really matters, it's that larger portions have more calories. I can't even say it with a straight face. But in fact, it's not intuitively obvious. If you give somebody a large portion of food, that person is going to eat more calories from that food than they otherwise would. And they're going to underestimate the number of calories they're eating by a much larger portion.
Why are they going to do that?
Human nature. It's the way we're wired.
Now, there are a lot of foods today, most processed foods especially, indicate the calories on the label, how many calories one mm-hmm. serving. Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing or is that confusing?
Well, it's I have to get very Talmudic about this. Yes, it's a good thing, and yes, it's confusing. It's a good thing because if people who are interested in learning about the caloric values of food can read it. It's confusing because it's per serving, and the serving sizes are ridiculously small in comparison to what people actually eat.
Really?
So, that's where the politics comes in, and that's why this book is from science to politics.
Right, and we're going to get into the politics, of course. But in terms of calories, is there any evidence on the opposite side? Is there any evidence that says, you know, calories really aren't all that important, it's X, Y, and Z that's important?
You don't believe in the second law of thermodynamics? You're violating a physical law here. Calories in, calories out determine what people weigh and what body weight is, and there's no getting around that. Where the calories come from is critically important for health, but not necessarily for weight.
What do you mean where the calories come from?
Whether the calories come from healthy foods or not healthy foods matters a lot to health, but it doesn't matter to weight.
I see. So what's a healthy food? What's a not healthy food?
Well, healthy foods are the kinds of things that have lots of vitamins, minerals, fiber, and good things along with the calories. Vegetables are probably the prototypical example of a really healthy food because they're very high in nutrients relative to their calorie content. And a soda is the prototypical junk food because it's got calories and no nutrients whatsoever.
Okay, so moving from there, well, one of the things you said in your book I found was very interesting was that in the 1980s, all of a sudden, there was a rise in obesity in the United States. Mm-hmm. And you didn't explain exactly why, but why did that happen?
Well, I think it happened for two reasons. Up until the 1980s, rates of obesity in the United States stayed about the same. They really didn't change very much. Starting in the early 1980s, they began to rise quite rapidly to current levels, and there was a doubling of obesity rates in adults and a tripling in children. And three things happened. First, there was a change in – none of them seem very immediately relevant to the food we eat. But one was a change in agricultural policy from a policy that paid farmers not to grow food to one that paid farmers to grow as much as they possibly could. And the result was an enormous increase in the number of calories in the food supply. This is federal policy. So the number of calories in the food supply rose from 3,200 in 1980 to the present 3,900 or 4,000 calories. And that's calories available in the food supply per person, every man, woman, and child. It's not what people are actually eating. It's what's available and has to be sold. So that was the first thing. The second was a change in the way Wall Street evaluated corporations. Up until the early 1980s, Wall Street highly valued blue chip stocks that gave long-term slow returns on investment. You never even hear about blue chip stocks anymore. Starting in about 1981 came the shareholder value movement, which was a big push to get higher immediate returns on investment. And Wall Street not only expected corporations to make a profit, but now it expected their profits to grow every 90 days. And we see the results of that on Wall Street now. For food corporations, it was devastating because they not only were trying to sell their products in a food environment in which there were twice as many calories as the country needed. 3,900 is about twice as much as most people need. But they also had to grow their profits every 90 days. And that caused food companies to start doing things to sell more food to more people at more time.
Like what?
Well, they raised portion sizes. So that was when portion sizes started to increase. A great sales technique. People love a bargain. They put food everywhere. I love asking the question, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? You know, that happened since the 1980s. Food is now everywhere, and it became socially acceptable to eat food in very large portions at all times of days, at all times of day and night, with a big push on making it socially acceptable to snack all the time. All of those are things that raise calorie intake without people realizing it, and the number of calories that people are eating has increased since the 1980s by measurable amounts.
You make a point in the book that the price of food has come down, that you can buy more food for less money today.
Yeah, America.
I wonder where that doesn't jibe with my trips to the grocery store.
It depends on what kind of food you buy. And part of it has to do with income. So because these figures are done as a percentage of income, and the United States spends the lowest percentage of its income on food than any other population in the world. We spend it's under 10% now of our income on food on average. And part of that is because we have a lot of really rich people. But part of it is because of the way the federal government subsidizes food commodities.
Now, when you say that the government essentially encouraged and the economic situation encouraged more food production, that doesn't necessarily mean that Americans had to eat that food. There's malnutrition in the rest of the world. We sell a lot of rice to the Far East and to other places. Doesn't the rest of the world take up some of the slack?
No, that 3,900 calorie figure is the amount that's produced in the United States, less exports plus imports. So it accounts for what's available within the continental and the other states that are not within the continent, but within the United States. It's a ballpark average, but the Department of Agriculture has been tracking those kinds of statistics since the early 1900s, and they give us a pretty good indication of what kind of what amount of food is available.
Now, what your concern here is with all foods, or are we talking essentially processed foods in terms of larger portions and so forth?
Oh, there's larger portions of everything. If you go to a restaurant, you get a much larger portion of food now than you did 20 or 30 years ago. Except in small plate restaurants. Bless them.
but really, I mean, people expect bigger portions today?
Well, you're used to it. I mean, the best example is a muffin or a bagel. The bagels that are sold in typical stores now are so much bigger than the bagels that I had when I was a kid. The ones that I had when I was a kid are now called mini bagels.
Really?
You know, and muffins used to be 2 ounces. Now they're 6 or 8 ounces. Larger portions have more calories.
And so all of this leads up to the big political and policy questions.
Well, you can't separate it.
No, well, you can just eat, I guess.
And most people do.
Right. So then you get into this whole question of, okay, we've established, and I assume there's scientific evidence to prove most of what you've said. It's in the book. Okay, then what do we do about it? Do we infringe on people's right of choice, freedom, whatever you want to call it, and tell them, no, you can't have a big soda like Mayor Bloomberg wanted to say, mm-hmm. or we're going to tax soda like the city of Richmond is trying to do? Or do you say, you know, we've told you this information, do what you want?
Well, these are some of the fundamental questions that American society is grappling with these days, and enormous sources of debate. But I look at it a slightly different way. I think the government is already heavily invested in the current food system and in the current way that we're eating. Right now, the default is to eat a lot of cheap junk food. The default could be to have it be that a healthy meal is the default choice. If you go into a fast food restaurant, the default kids' meal is junk food. You could ask fast food restaurants to make the default meal for kids a healthy meal, and then if parents wanted to get junk food for their kids, they could order it. Nobody would stop them from doing it.
I don't know what you mean, though.
Let me explain it then. The real question is, what's the normal, obvious, easy thing to do that you do without thinking about it? You go to a vending machine, and what's in the vending machine is the default. It's what's right there. You go to a restaurant and order something, what you're given is the default. The menu is the default. You go to a fast food restaurant and order a meal for your kids, the Happy Meal comes already prepared for you. That's the default. Right now, the defaults in most of these places are junk foods or foods that are in much too large portions or much bigger than you really need or necessarily want. And we know that people will eat the amount of food that is presented to them. We know that. There's plenty of research that proves that. And so if you gave people smaller portions, they would eat less food. Mayor Bloomberg's idea was to limit the size of sodas to 2 servings, not 4 or 6 or 8 servings. A 16-ounce soda is 2 servings of soda. And to do that would immediately that would be the default choice. And that would help people not drink so many calories from sodas. It's an interesting approach. It was met with a lot of pushback.
Well, pushback is one word for it. Derision or the John Stewart approach is another way to look at it. You know, Big Brother telling us what to eat.
But I mean, Big Brother is already telling us what to eat.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. Before I do that, though, there was another question about the book that I was curious about. You said people are eating out more, and when you go out to a restaurant, you end up eating more calories. And I'm not sure why that is.
Because restaurant portions are enormous.
But they aren't always enormous.
They're pretty big, and you have no way of knowing how a restaurant meal is cooked unless you're in the kitchen with the chef, watching the way the food is prepared and weighing every ingredient to know how much it weighs so you can figure out the calories. And nobody can estimate how much they're eating in restaurants. And I say this because I certainly can't. And I know this
really?
Because... Well, yes, I was taken to lunch once by a reporter for the New York Times who wanted to humiliate me and did it very effectively. And she took me and one of my doctoral students to a restaurant in Manhattan that had a really nice Italian restaurant. And she asked us to write down the number of calories in each of the dishes that we were served. And then she sent those dishes off to a lab to be analyzed. And we were so normally off. We were off by the 30% to 40% that people always are when they are trying to guess the number of
always
calories
less.
In meals. Always less.
Really?
Guessing the number of meals. And there was no way in the world that I would ever have guessed that this little tiny portion, lunch-sized portion of risotto at this lovely Italian restaurant would have 1,200 calories and 4 ounces of fat in it. And 1,200 calories? How would that be possible? And a chef said afterwards, if you knew anything about what goes on in the kitchen, you would know how risotto was made. The rice is steeped in olive oil. They add a handful of butter and another handful of cheese. Of course it has 1,200 calories.
Wow. Well, one of the things you talked about in the book, 1 teaspoon of salad oil has the equivalent calories of an apple.
Yeah, if a small apple, yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, fat has 9 calories per gram, and apples are mostly water. So they don't have very many calories.
You know, when you talk about calories, get back to the beginning of your book, you explain what calories are and how you measure them. I mean, basically, you take a food and you burn it, and you see how much heat it produces and how much water you can boil or heat up with it.
Well, that's where thermodynamics comes in because calories are a measure of energy.
But does anyone dispute that? Does anybody say calories, you know, that's a funny way to measure anything and maybe that isn't the only way to do it?
Oh, there are lots of disputes about the accuracy of those measurements.
Yeah?
Because the measurements have to be corrected. Burning food outside the body is not the same as burning food inside the body because we excrete nitrogen. It's not burned. Different foods are digested at different rates and so forth. And so there are a lot of disputes about the accuracy. And I think you can never look at calories as chemical tables. The numbers have a lot of fuzziness around them. And one of the things that people have to get used to is a lot of uncertainty. an individual variation in all of this. And you have to get comfortable with that. And for a lot of people, that's not comfortable.
Let me remind our audience, we're talking to Marion Nestle, who's the author, co-author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. And one of the things you say in here is this is not a diet book. And you make that emphatic. And yet there are some aspects that you could read this book and decide what kind of a diet you wanted, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. We wanted to give people the tools to analyze diets so they could understand how diets work and whether some diets are going to work better than others. But people who are reading it are telling us that it's really been very, very helpful to them in weight management. I was kind of surprised by that, but that's great.
That's good. So it is a sort of a diet book. I want to give
in
out
disguise.
A phone, in disguise, right? I want to give out a phone number so after our break you can call us and send us an email and all that. 866-733-6786. That's forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Let me get the number again, 866-733-6786, and you can talk to Marion Nestle. And we can talk about calories, and she's good at advice here. It's a fascinating subject. Let me read a couple of – we've already got a bunch of emails here. I'd like to hear Marion's reaction to Gary Taub's assertion that it's really our body's insulin reaction to carbs and sugar that makes us obese versus total calories.
Oh, I'm a great fan of Robert Lustig at UCSF, who is so strong about these kinds of issues. And he talks all the time about how sugar and rapidly absorbable carbohydrates in large amounts are really bad for us. But if you push him on it, which I've done on various occasions, there's a dose response here. And up to a point, it's really okay to eat sugars and carbohydrates. It's just that probably more than 2 ounces a day is getting into the whole insulin business. So the idea that having too many carbohydrates raises insulin levels and causes you to put on weight is true, but it means you have to eat a lot of it.
More basic question, can a nutritionist like yourself, who teaches and have studied all this, is this a subject that you get into? Is this a subject for a different kind of scientist? Who really studies this kind of thing?
Oh, nutrition scientists, medical doctors. There's a huge amount of research being done on this, particularly since obesity came into prominence as a national public health issue. There are vast organizations of scientists who are studying these issues and trying to figure out how all this works.
A message here from Colin. When I was a child, my peers' diet was not much better than the diets today, yet few of us were obese. At that time, however, most of the meat did not contain growth hormones, as factory farming was not as big as it is now. What role, if any, do you think that growth hormones in meat play in making children obese?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, but I don't. I wish that were something that somebody were studying a lot more. I think it's worth study. There are many hypotheses out now about not only growth hormone in meat and other kinds of factors in meat, but also the synthetic estrogens that are found in plastics and other kinds of chemicals in the food supply. I think we need a lot more research to see what kinds of effects those are having on people's health. But I don't think you need any elaborate theories to explain rising rates of obesity. All you need is calories. People are eating more calories than they're expending, and there's a huge amount of evidence for that. And that's really all it takes. It doesn't take any more than that.
Okay, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We're talking with Marion Nestle, who's the author of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Interesting book, part science, part politics, part diet book, whether you like it or not. But it's a fascinating study, and we'll talk some more with Marion after we get back from the break. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels in for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Marion Nestle. Why Calories Count is her book, From Science to Politics. Incidentally, she's going to make a couple of appearances, three actually, at bookstores in the Bay Area. Friday, 5 p.m., the Book Passage in Corte Madera. Saturday at noon at the Book Passage in San Francisco at the Ferry Building. And Saturday at 3 o'clock. Omnivore Books.
Oh, it's a wonderful place.
That's a great title.
On Church and Cesar Chavez.
All right. Very good. We've got some phone calls, which we'll take in a minute. One of the things that I have a hard time understanding exactly, does the government, nobody in the government says, let's promote unhealthy food. I don't think. Let's make our country obese. Let junk food rule the roost. But you're talking about politics and so forth. Bottom line, big companies that produce food trying to influence policy. What's going on?
Well, look at the amount of money that the soda industry is putting into trying to defeat soda taxes. Look at the money that any food company is putting into lobbying or any other kind of activity in order to protect its interests. Food companies are about selling food. They're not sitting around a conference table saying, let's make Americans fat. They're sitting around a conference table saying, how are we going to sell our food product in an environment in which there are 3,900 calories per day for every man, woman, and little tiny baby in the country. Most people don't need all that. We're hugely competitive. Wall Street wants us to grow our profits every 90 days, which is practically impossible to do. How are we going to deal with that? That's what they're dealing with on a daily basis. They're not public health agencies.
But isn't there an argument to be made that people know a lot of what you say in this book, not everything, not the science, perhaps, not the definition of calories and kilocalories. But everybody knows that if you eat a lot of French fried potatoes and hamburgers and Coke, it's going to affect you. And why do we need the government to kind of come in and say, mm-hmm. we don't want to.
I get asked that all the time, and I observe it all the time. People know it on one level, but they don't know it on another level. And the best example that I can think of is the business with large portions. There is now research from several different researchers who have done studies to show that even people who are trained to know that larger portions have more calories, when confronted with a large portion, will still eat more calories from it than they would if the portion were smaller, underestimate the number of calories from that portion by a much greater percentage. And so you're dealing with something that's at a cognitive level and something that it's at a non-cognitive or emotional level. That's just the way humans are wired. And so food companies know this, and they appeal to the non-cognitive level, as was explained to me by somebody who was in advertising. The entire purpose of advertising is to slip below the radar of critical thinking. And it makes people furious when they're told something like that. Nobody wants to think that they're being manipulated. And yet we are manipulated by the food environment that we're in ways that we can't see. And when we're confronted with it, we don't like it. And I think that's what's going on with the Bloomberg 16-ounce soda business, where the reaction to that has been one of absolute fury, hostility, ridicule, and everything else, when all he's trying to do is to make it easier for people to eat smaller portions. Now, what I want is for restaurants to give a price break for a smaller portion. I'd like to go into a restaurant and say, I'd like a half portion. I'm willing to pay a premium for that half portion. But why should you have to pay more for smaller portions? There's something wrong with that.
Where do you have to pay more for smaller
portions? An 8-ounce soda costs much more per ounce than a 2-liter.
Per ounce?
Yeah, than a 2-liter soda does. Hmm. You pay a lot more for an 8-ounce soda.
All right, let's get our audience involved here. Paula in Richmond is on the line. Hello, Paula, you're on Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I agree with your guest on everything she said so far. I have a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old. Since they were babies, I've taught them we have to go against the norm to be healthy. We have to go out of our way to choose our food because we are bombarded with so many easy choices. So that's number one, and they take that advice. We're lucky in the Bay Area. We have so many good choices. But whenever I leave to go traveling, like back in the Midwest, I get so anxious. I'm so anxious because there's so it's too easy to get junk food. And when you drive on freeways, the billboards, they always have the billboards that say when the next the fast food restaurants are, where they all are. And I think that those signs should be taken off the freeways.
Interesting thought.
Thank you so much for saying that. The whole object is to make healthy choices the easy choices. That's exactly the approach. You people in California are so lucky. You're so spoiled with all the good food you have. It's such a pleasure to come out from the East Coast and see the foods in the markets and the stores and everywhere here. You're so lucky.
We'll take that as a compliment. Here's a question from Hassam, who says, does it make a difference if you consume 1,000 calories from a candy bar than from a natural food? I think we should educate our children not about calories, but about processed foods, because no matter how many calories you consume from natural food, your brain is wired to stop at a certain point. But if you consume processed foods, your brain is not wired in such a way to understand when to stop eating the processed foods.
Oh, I like that. That's really a nice way to put it. There are some people, David Kessler, for example, the former head of the FDA who lives out here, has a book, The End of Overeating, in which he argues exactly that point, that food companies deliberately manipulate the ingredients in processed foods in order to make you want more and more and more of them, whereas the foods that come from nature didn't do that. So avoiding processed foods is a really good way to help manage your weight.
All right. Casey in Burlingame. Hi, you're on Forum.
Yeah, I had a question about Professor Lustig's video about how sugars are much more detrimental to the body than other calories, and they're not processed in the same way. They're processed by the liver and so on. And I wanted to make a quick point about government and causing problems in food. The unintended consequences of the Bloomberg decision is that diet sodas are still able to be consumed in large amounts, and there could be an argument made that those are much more detrimental even than the sugar ones,
because
as far as cancer and diabetes are concerned.
Why would that be?
Because of the fake sugar and the chemical that it is rather poisonous if it's by itself.
Okay. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of artificial sweeteners, mainly because I don't like the way they taste. And at least I know how sugar is going to be metabolized in the body, and I have no idea what those things are doing. But yeah, there are flaws. And, you know, what Bloomberg is doing is to choose an easy target, because sweetened soft drinks are sugars and calories and nothing else but, and there's no nutritional value along with them. But there are lots of other things I would have done too, but I'm not the czar of these things.
Well, you're getting to be.
He is.
I wonder, everybody knocks the soft drinks, especially the ones with sugar, but isn't there something to be said for the fact that you want to drink a lot of fluid in your life, and maybe you don't want to drink water? Maybe water is not what you want to do all the time. And the fact that these drinks taste good is an incentive to drink them.
Yeah, the diet soft drink business is complicated. It does have these chemicals in it, and the FDA says those chemicals are safe and okay, at least at the amounts currently consumed. And I'm not going to get into arguments about that. But what seems very clear is that drinking diet soft drinks has no effect on body weight. In fact, if you want to do bad epidemiology, you can draw a curve of the increase in rates of obesity and the increase in use of artificial sweeteners, and they go up exactly in parallel.
Why?
Because there's some, I mean, a lot of people have hypotheses to explain why that might be. One possibility is that it keeps the taste for sweet in the brain. And so the brain continues to crave those kinds of things. And then you eat more calories to make up for it. I don't know.
You finish the Diet Coke and you go buy a
And you go buy something that makes up for the calories. So I don't know. There's not very much evidence that on a population basis they're helping keep the weight down.
Okay. Joey in Palo Alto.
I don't think they taste good, but that's just me.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead, Joey.
Oh, hi. Marion, thanks so much for this this book. It's so illuminating. I just wanted to hear your views on this, but let me tell you what I believe. When I go to restaurants, if they have especially lard in, like, the tortilla chips or butter, I go home and I feel my stomach immediately, like, swell up like a medium-sized volleyball, and I'm not overweight. Okay, and I've worked hard not to be overweight, and it's no thanks to our school system, you know, because I remember, anyway, so that's one thing. I feel it immediately when they use lard and butter in their food, the restaurants, and then I wish there were more restaurants that sold small portions. I always take food home, and my husband is constantly making fun of me in a good way. You know, he's like, we have science projects in the refrigerator, you know. He says it's turning into mold, which it doesn't. But at any rate, the point is, I wish restaurants sold small portions. I don't eat that much because I've taught myself for over the years to eat small portions. And then the other, lastly, is teach kids need to learn from grade school and throw in the parents how to eat well. Fine, you have the pyramids, you have that chart. Show me, give me examples in grade school. Okay, you need to eat like an apple and milk and like whole wheat toast with peanut butter and jelly. That's fine. Okay, next lunch and so on, you know, for dinner. I mean, I see the Jamie Oliver and him doing his thing, that guy from the Food Network, and he was here in the Bay Area, I think, a couple of years ago, trying to do something with lunch programs here in the public schools of the Sacramento area, here in the Bay Area. And I thought, yay, we need more of that. Because I look around and I try and teach, like, any kid, you know, like, child, you know, this stuff, what is it that they put in that? Hydrogenated blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm talking about.
Oil.
That is, like, so terrible. It's like, you see that on the label? Read labels. Do not
all right.
eat that. Fresh fruit. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Those
all right.
three things. And I'd like to hear Marion comment. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joey.
I'm overwhelmed. Thanks for your comments.
Yeah. Okay.
Next.
All right. Oh, it's great. This is a subject people get passionate about.
Well, isn't that wonderful?
I consider it
a full employment act.
Well, that's good for you. Okay. Joseph in San Francisco. How you doing?
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have my degree in nutrition, my undergraduate degree, and one of the things that I thought was challenging is that people undervalue nutritional science, and there's more of a credence given to fad diets like the South Beach diet, Dr. Atkins, or however it's being recycled currently. And a classic example is Americans' obsession with protein. And I have overweight and obese people telling me that they need more protein all the time when, in fact, Americans eat three times more protein than they really need. Why? How do you overcome that? That attraction to the fad diet versus just the hard science that, you know, that's sort of been proven. How do you get people to accept that rather than to just sell out to the moneymakers?
That's an interesting question, and she's going to answer it in a second. But the fact that is proven is an interesting word, because I'm not convinced some of this is really proven. But anyway, go ahead, Marianne.
Yeah, well, I love the question, and it's one I grapple with all the time. And I just want to say one thing about the protein business, because when the My Plate came out, that's the Department of Agriculture's dietary advice to the American people that shows half the plate with fruits and vegetables, roughly a quarter of the plate has protein on it. protein. Why do they have to push protein? It just doesn't make any sense at all. We don't have any protein deficiency in this country. Everybody has plenty of protein. Probably the average intake of protein in this country is 2 or 3 times the actual requirement for it. So the caller is absolutely right about that. And this is such a deep misunderstanding that even the Department of Agriculture did it. And when I yelled and screamed and said, why'd you put protein in that? When in fact, two of the other sectors of the plate, the grain part and the dairy part, also have protein. They say, well, everybody understands what protein is. Really? I didn't think so. And I didn't think the plate showed that everybody understood what protein is. But the real question is, why is nutrition science so complicated? It is complicated, and it's complicated because humans make just terrible experimental animals. We can't lock humans in cages for 50 years and feed them defined diets and compare one kind of a diet to another. We have to let people go about their daily activities doing and eating and whatever they feel like doing during the period of studies. And so there are always real difficulties in controlling the experiments. There are very, very few well-controlled human experimental trials because they're impossible to control. And so the results of the studies always require interpretation. They're never clearly black or white. They're always kind of gray. And the minute you get into interpretation of studies, you get into the biases of the interpreters.
But doesn't that reflect on what you're trying to say as well?
Well, yes, and we try to say in our book exactly how we're interpreting the science. This is our interpretation of the science. You want to read the original studies, here they are. You can read them and decide for yourself whether you agree with our interpretation or not. I don't see how we can do any better than that. That's the best we can do, given the available research on these topics right now. I happen to find the research fascinating. So I like reading it and like interpreting it and like trying to pull conclusions out of it, particularly the studies that compare one kind of diet to another. These studies cannot possibly control for calorie intake because they're dealing with people who are out in the real world.
Huh, that's interesting. Well, which brings us to you talk in the book, you use the word move. Which is another word for exercise, essentially.
Or activity.
Activity, but even exercising. Mm-hmm. How important is that in this whole... Can you forget about calories if you exercise enough?
If you run marathons all the time, yes, because you're going to be working off so many of those calories. But for most normal people, working off calories from food is much harder to do than it is to eat less. And the easiest example for that is that if you have one of those 20-ounce sodas that has nearly 300 calories in it, you're going to have to walk an average of about 3 miles in order to work off the calories in that. Physical activity just doesn't burn that many calories unless you're really being enormously active or you're very big and your activity is very intense. And there's much better evidence for the idea that people are eating more now than there is for the fact that they're moving less. It seems intuitively obvious that people are moving less now than they did 20 or 30 years ago.
Go by a gym. All these people are in the gym exercising.
Yeah, but most people are not in gyms. Most people are not in gyms. And there were people in gyms 20 years ago, too. But there's so much evidence that people are eating more. So much evidence from so many different lines of research that you have to ask the question, why are people eating more and how do we get people not to eat so much if they're worried about their weight? Moving more is very good for health. I'm for it.
Right. And the answer to that question is, how do you get people to eat less? I mean, that's a whole program, but we'll deal with that at some point. Let's talk to Robert in Fairfax. What's going on, Robert?
Yes. Hello there. I'm curious to know this. I hope it wasn't already asked in the program, but many people advocate eating what they call the Paleolithic diet. I just heard a program yesterday. A guy wrote a book called Neanderthin, and it kind of makes logical sense to me when I think about the millions of years of evolution that we obviously evolved as hunters and gatherers. And just what do you think of that whole thesis that we'd be healthier eating that sort of a diet.
It'd kind of be kind of uncomfortable to go chasing animals, wouldn't it? I don't know, kind of difficult. I like it in theory. It's a lot of fun to talk about. But I wonder about the basic premises, because one of the big intellectual challenges in the study of diet and health is to figure out what people are eating as opposed to what they say they're eating. And in the case of Paleolithic times, you don't really have anybody that you can ask. So you're totally, I mean, even, or watch, you can't watch them or measure what they're eating. So you're kind of dependent on archaeological and other kinds of indirect evidence to figure out what it was that people were eating. And the one part about that that makes me kind of a little bit skeptical is that the physical remains of animals last through the centuries much, much better than the physical remains of plants. It's pretty hard to figure out what the balance was between plant and animal foods in prehistoric times, because plants are destroyed and bones last, and so you can, and shells last, and other kinds of things last much better. So I think the archaeological scientists are still trying to figure out what the real evidence for that is.
You know, you've talked several times about how difficult it is to measure certain parts of this, to do research on it. And yet, the other thing you're doing is you're pretty definite about what seems to work and what's important. Too many calories, you get fat, you get diseases. Vegetables are better to eat than sugar and candy and diet. I'm hearing sort of two different strains here, that it's very hard to do research here, but we really know what's good for you.
Well, we know some things about what's good for us. And we certainly know that it's better to meet nutritional requirements than not to meet nutritional requirements. It's better to have enough food so that you're not losing weight and starving. One of the sections of this book is what happens when you don't have enough calories. And there, the physiology has been studied extremely well. That's right. Physiological work. Where the scientific questions come in.
Yeah, where's the dispute?
If you look at diets throughout the world, people are able to exist and flourish on diets of enormous variety. People have always taken advantage of the foods that were available and at hand, and managed to at least live through reproductive years. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Where the big arguments come in is whether one food is better than another, or one kind of diet is better or another. And you can't do those kinds of experiments because you can't put people in cages for 50 or 100
years. Can't control the experiment.
But what you do know is that we evolved to eat real foods. We know about what happened during evolution. We evolved to eat fruits, vegetables, meat, dairy, whatever. People have existed on combinations of those foods for millennia. We did not evolve to eat junk food. That's a new innovation. That's new in American history. And it's the effect of vast quantities of processed foods on our health that are still raising lots of questions.
That's a good point. We did not evolve to eat junk food. That's good. Here's somebody who Pete sends us an email. I do eat a grapefruit with breakfast, and I've been told this helps burn calories. Is that true?
The last appendix in our book is myths about calories. And one of them is that there are calories that burn calories more. You lose more calories in digesting these foods than you would by eating them. And unfortunately, that doesn't work, because all of the calorie values take digestion into consideration. So there are calories in grapefruit, just not very many.
I see.
They're delicious. I love them.
David sends us a note. In these discussions, I always think about the so-called French paradox. Does Miss Nessel have any thoughts about the French diet? I imagine the French consume huge numbers of calories, all that butter, cream, and cheese, yet most of them seem to live relatively long, healthy lives.
Well, I don't know about most anymore, and it's certainly changing. The French diet is really interesting. It does have a lot of butter and cheese and all those other yummy things, but they don't eat them in very large portions. And historically and culturally, the French don't eat between meals. Not at all.
Really?
And so they eat.
Come on, all those cafes that are filled with people all the time in the streets of Paris?
They're not gorging in those cafes.
They're drinking wine?
They're having coffee. Oh, yes, and unfortunately, alcohol does have calories. That's true. But there's very, very little of snacking all day or eating between meals. The meals are very contained. They're very satisfying. They're consumed historically. I'm not sure this is even true anymore, but culturally and historically, they were consumed very slowly. They ate a lot of bread, but the bread didn't have butter on it. There are lots of hypotheses. I don't think anybody has the answer.
All right. Here's a call about government getting involved. Go ahead. You're on forum.
Yeah. I'm an environmental lawyer, and I think the whole debate needs to be changed from this concept of a nanny state. You know, we don't allow people to drive down the highway spewing all kinds of, exhaust out of their tailpipes or, coming out of the chimneys of manufacturing plants. But we don't outlaw driving and we don't outlaw manufacturing plants. We just make those activities bear the costs, you know, that they incur. And so, to me, the way to have the freedom to choose to be fat if you want to, and yet bear the cost of it, is to have a tax that is committed to education and health care and so forth. And people are going to say, "Well, that's way too complicated. The issue's too complicated." But we don't have any problem, for example, paying for our interstate highways with a federal gas tax, even though we might argue there might be all kinds of people that pay that tax that never get on an interstate highway. So I think we've got we need to change the debate here to get to the point where, you know, it becomes acceptable to crudely impose a tax and use it in a lockbox for both education and health care.
It sounds like we're moving in that direction a little bit anyway. There seems to be discussion of it. We've got a minute or so left.
As the astronomical costs of obesity and its consequences, not only personal consequences for individuals who have type 2 diabetes or whatever, but also the cost to society in the health care costs of people who have lifetime chronic diseases, as we consider those kinds of costs more and more, I think people are going to be looking more and more at those kinds of solutions to the problem. But right now we're in the interim stage where the food industry has done a really good job of accusing any kind of intervention as nanny state-ism, and attacking the science and attacking the critics.
And
so here we are.
Here we are. That's going to be the last word. Marion Nestle, the author of Why Calories Count, along with Malden Nesheim. And it's a book about from science to politics. It's about food, and it's an interesting read. Thank you very much, Marion, for being
pleasure.
With us. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Spencer Michaels. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.